Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Oh, wow. Wow, wow. My wonderful audience. This is an exciting day in my life. You don't know it yet, but this is now not just a radio show, but it's a TV show. This will be going up probably every Thursday or Friday after the Wednesday show as a podcast on my YouTube channel of an hour on film, thanks to wonderful PRN. Thanks to the wonderful PRN. I'm beaming. You can't see me because the beaming won't go up for another couple of days, but we should have it up on our YouTubes by every Friday, maybe Thursday afternoon. So it is now welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour radio and TV. Wow. I'm hoping that this will enhance a lot of the viewing that we do. I hope it will enhance your enjoyment. I hope it will bring more attention to PRN because my channel is pretty big and good. So I just think this is such an exciting day. I'll remind you briefly, it's November 6th, 2019, a good day. And that my website is breggin.com. And I have on with me today to start it, I mean, three of us beaming together, one beaming a little less because she's nervous. And she's Pinar Miski. Now I have her smiling. This is probably a bit much for Pinar. But she, you're going to see Pinar Miski, and she teaches my course on Pan Popper's website. You can get to it from mine, breggin.com. And it's my big course where you can learn all about what I think and also learn about coming off meds. I've got like 25 or more videos there. You'll see Pan Popper on it. And then you do interaction live with this beaming, glorious human being, Pinar Miski. And when you see her, you'll agree with me. You'll agree with me. So I'm looking at her on my screen now so you can understand, and she's waving at me. And Pam Popper, oh my God, my dear friend Pam. Hi, Pam. Oh, yes, say things, say things.
Hi. I think this is fun. I've not done this before. It's a good time. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. And Pinar, I'm sure you've not done it before. So Pam Popper, she's founder and president of the Wellness Health, Form Health. Pam is also the author of Food Over Medicine. And if you really want to change your life entirely, see the film Forks Over Knives that's been seen by, I think, tens of millions now. You'll see a much younger Pam on it, but Pam looks fabulous. Have you been, had yourself all made up, Pam? You look really great.
No, I mean, I'm just at work, but I just turned 63. Thank you for saying I look fabulous. I just turned 63 last week.
Oh, my God.
I can't believe how old I am. I don't feel that old. I'm too young to be 63.
Well, you know, we have almost three generations of people here, with Pinar, you, and then me. We do. We have at least three generations among us. A lot of wisdom.
Oh, I'm turning 40 in a couple weeks, so that's...
Oh, you look 12, I swear. No, wait. Wait till people get to see you. They will
tomorrow
say...
Tomorrow we have to have birthday celebration. Pinar is coming to Columbus tomorrow, so we'll have birthday time.
Oh, well, that's sweet. I wish I were there with you.
We do.
See, So you can see I'm pretty excited about this. I'm not going to do a lot of introductions more than this. You know, Pinar's a psychiatrist in Baltimore, in addition to doing my show, but she's not in private practice, so you can't go see her. I'm encouraging her. And she does consultation work full-time to a medical hospital. Wow. I mean, that is a variety of ways she gets to see people and intervene in their lives. Pam has a PhD in nutrition, and she's really a physician, and she has just wonderful alternatives to get in touch with her and improve your health by hiring her, talking with her. She's not technically a physician in the state of Ohio, but she's just a wonderful health promoter for me and Ginger, and I send my friends to her when in need. And I thought it might be really interesting to do something special for day one of the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on radio and TV. And that is to talk about important events in our professional lives. Now, for me, it's pretty hard to separate my wife, Ginger, from my professional life. I'll do that a little bit. But I think mainly to talk about what are some of the high points in our professional lives. And I'll start out with a couple. And then we'll see, maybe we can go into depth in them. And I'm planning folks to have this bit of a combination on, the three of us regularly. We're going to make sure about our scheduling. And then maybe once in a while, somebody will be away and we'll bring in somebody else. But I want to tune these folks up because I think they're worth watching once a month and listening to once a month in various combinations, perhaps. And I can imagine eventually Pam handling it when I'm away and that kind of thing. So I won't inflict that on Pinar. So, you know, I've had a number of key events in my life, but as many of you know, what changed my life forever was when I was at Harvard and I was a freshman and I was studying American history and literature and I was going to be a professor and maybe a lawyer, but I wasn't too sure. But I thought I'd be a thoughtful professor and I'd teach and so on and so forth. And a friend of mine invited me out to volunteer in a state mental hospital. And when I got to that hospital, it was just intimidating to see all these buildings up on a hill. And we went in and we were led to the women's violent ward. And I don't think I felt apprehensive. But going through, it was strange. It stank. It smelled bad. It reminded me of my Uncle Dutch's descriptions of liberating a Nazi concentration camp. The patients we saw along the way were bedraggled. We went through iron locked doors, one after another. I mean, that's how hard it was to get in and out. One ward after another was contiguous. And It was dismal. People were lying on the floor, people talking to themselves. Nobody hardly was socializing. There were heavy wire on the windows. It was probably in the fall, must have been around in September, I think, or maybe a little later. And when I got onto the women's ward, there were just a few of us for this particular visit. And I was told that that's our Radcliffe student, former Radcliffe student, and she was lying on the floor in a corner. And my first feeling was there, but for the grace of God, go I. It wasn't like, ugh, or oh, who could that be, or I'd never end up like that, or why doesn't she get up? It was more like, God, with a little worse luck, me too. And within that year, I became a leader of the program. We had hundreds of people going through the hospital. And the next year, I talked the superintendent into having a case aid program where 12 of us had our own patients. They were real scared and upset. And they were upset with me for even pushing hard. And we had already had a lot of good publicity for them. So when I said that I thought another hospital was interested, they said, well, you don't run it, but we'll do this. You don't run our hospital. So I was really sort of obnoxious, obstreperous, lacking in boundaries when it came to other professionals way back then. We set up that program, and we ended up getting 12 out of 15 of these patients out of the hospital and into better circumstances or home. I wrote about this in depth in Toxic Psychiatry, and all of a sudden I was somebody in the field of mental health as a college kid. I had my picture in the Saturday Evening Post, and we had a write-up in a big mental health summary and of the future of mental health put out by the federal government, and all of a sudden I was doing things. Now, what I didn't know, and then I'm going to hand it over, what I didn't know is that psychiatry doesn't progress. Psychiatry goes with the winds of power and money, with the fads of science and pseudoscience. So what was new and exciting in the psychiatry of the 1950s that had Harvard professors interested in our work? I remember a long train ride I took with a very high-ranking professor of psychiatry so we could both present when I was probably a junior in college at a conference at Yale. I mean, it was that kind of business. What was accepted in psychiatry as at least a viable help and alternative in the way of human services is no longer acceptable, because the word is you can't talk to schizophrenics, and they all need a ton of drugs. So I'm going to take a deep breath and say hi to Pam. And hello, my friend. I'm so glad you're here with me on opening day of the Peter Breggin Hour on radio and TV.
Me too. Thank you. This is great.
So, where do you want to begin? Do you want to talk about what it feels like to be there? You want to talk about the question of, you know, like, what were turning points for you in your profession?
I'll tell you one that's really important, and it tangentially pertains to a friend of yours, a mutual friend of ours. And that is that shortly after I got into this business and I started helping people, my landlord's wife developed a very large, like, lemon-shaped tumor on her neck. And you probably know the outcomes for people who have head and neck cancer are not so good. And so she was smart enough to know that she shouldn't need to do the therapy, the chemotherapy, and all that sort of thing. I mean, the outcomes are life expectancy is about 2 years, right? So we started doing some research, and it was more difficult back then because of the internet. You couldn't find things on the internet. It was so primitive. But we networked our way to a person who's become a good friend of mine, Dr. Ralph Moss, who had experienced a whole cataclysmic event we could talk about another time, but at Memorial Sloan Kettering. But he had started his own company to issue what he calls Moss reports. So he goes all over the world and he visits the clinics and he knows if there's something interesting going on in cancer treatment, he knows about it. So anyway, I'll tell you the end of the story in a minute, because it's a happy story with this woman. But I'll never forget this, because I didn't really have much experience helping cancer patients. And the first thing Dr. Moss said to me is, you need to change your approach. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he goes, you people, because he was talking about me being part of you people. He goes, you people are so intent on getting rid of the cancer sometimes, you don't really care if it kills the patient too. And I never heard anything like that before. And it was the first time that somebody suggested that we should look at this differently. Like, maybe even if the cancer stays around and the patient's alive, that would be a better outcome, right? So that really stuck with me. And his whole evidence-based approach, looking at everything from an evidentiary standpoint, was really, really influential. So I have to share that, because this has a happy ending and it's really worth talking about. So what happened was, this woman decided to have the tumor removed, of course. What they proposed to her after that was ludicrous. We did some research with Dr. Moss. He told us about a treatment protocol they use in Germany that involves hyperthermia to the lymph nodes, low-dose radiation, and a nutritional protocol. And there was a doctor in California who offered it. So she went to California for 3 months. And this was back in 1997 or 98. He's still alive today. You know how many head and neck cancer patients alive this? And so every year, she actually, because she had a little girl, she recuperated after the surgery in the house and then went to California. And every year on the anniversary of her diagnosis, she calls me to thank me. And I usually meet her at Starbucks or something like that. And so it kind of makes me, and I had, later on, I brought Dr. Moss here for a conference, and she gave the introduction to him. which was just a beautiful thing to watch. So happy ending by looking at the way that you keep people alive instead of, my gosh, let's try to get rid of every cancer cell in her body. And if we kill her too, well, that's just the price you pay. That's so much what cancer treatment is about. So you and I have a mutual contact who has cancer, who's been using a much different approach and is still alive as a result of it. And so today, Dr. Moss is still influencing me today. So that's my one of my stories about major moments.
And what was the big change in the treatment approach? I'm not sure that that came across.
Well, what normally happens is you have surgery. Everybody agrees you take the tumor out. And then, of course, the assumption is if it's most of the time it's metastasized. So now we need to get serious about chemotherapy and radiation. And so the chemotherapy and radiation are horrifically damaging. And in many instances, particularly radiation, can sometimes make the cancer progress faster. Chemotherapy gets rid of the cancer cells, and then sometimes they come back, they mutate and come back. And so the approach that they use in Germany, and this is kind of an interesting thing I learned about too. The United States is the only country, westernized country, in which traditional medical Western medicine is grown up. It's crowded out everything. In Germany,
they're
still
on her side.
So they use these combination protocols. Yeah, a little bit of chemo is a good idea, or a little bit of radiation. But instead of just blasting people with these toxic chemicals and this radiation, it's much more intelligent application.
Am I filling the screen? Pam, I have a question about the screen and how it's working.
Yeah.
You two are very nicely centered in the screen and filling up a lot of it. Am I further back than that?
No. You're fine.
Okay, great. Well, that's good. I want to tell folks a bit about Pinar and why she's getting up and down at times. And that is, Pinar is on call right now. So she gets calls and she gets things happening, and she may just have to listen to a phone or get up. And I'm glad that she has volunteered, because my 4 o'clock on Wednesday's hour is a time when she is saving lives. So welcome back. And Pinar, we're talking about, you know, the key things that got us started in our work, and on any level or at any time, when you were a kid or when you were a mature woman or whenever.
Yeah, you assume I'm a mature woman.
Yeah, you'll do it.
So I never was one of those people that wanted to be a physician my whole life. I don't know if you were ever one of those folks. But I fell into the mental health field because I just enjoyed psychology in college so much. Like, I just went into college open-minded, not sure, liberal arts majors to start with. And psychology came kind of easy. Like, I literally didn't have to study and I would ace everything. And it was just like, I don't know how that happened, but let's just go with it. And then when it came time to, am I going to be a PhD or something else? I decided, let's just go the MD route. It keeps my options more open. So I was just kind of cautiously going into it. And just by some miracle, I basically was very lucky enough to get into a medical school at the last minute, and decided to pursue the field. And even going into medical school, I was still kind of in denial of, like, okay, am I sure I want to do psychiatry? I was still open-minded. I enjoy working with my hands, doing artistic endeavors. Maybe I could be a surgeon. I enjoy the intellectual stimulation of internal medicine and trying to diagnose things. Maybe I could be an internist or a family medicine practitioner. But in the end, I kind of realized I felt like the power of the mind is the most powerful force in the universe. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just decided psych was the right thing to do. And, you know, I think, like all three of us, I kind of went into the field just kind of doing my thing, not really thinking too much of it, you know, didn't really do anything deviated, anything unusual. I do remember when I got my first job, I did a consultation liaison psychiatry fellowship after my fourth year of residency. And I just assume I'm going to do consults because I enjoy both medicine and psychiatry. And I find that this is kind of my niche, and I really enjoy helping people on both fronts. But my previous supervisor really encouraged me to find my thing. You know, like, you got to find your specialty. You got to find something that you're passionate about, that you enjoy. And I really struggled. Like, I didn't have a specialty. I felt like my colleagues around me would specialize in, like, women's health or this, that, or the other, and I didn't really have that. And then I actually ended up going to my library just randomly, and I noticed the billboard, and it was advertising a talk about preventing diabetes. And I have a bunch of family members who have diabetes, and that they were suffering the consequences of that. So I basically thought, this is kind of interesting. What the heck? Why not? Let me go investigate this, both for my family members as well as myself, because it's in my family. Wanted to prevent, you know, any illness in myself. And I ended up going to the talk, and it was by Dr. Neil Bernard of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. So he presented this data, and it seemed very scientific and very valid and legitimate, and it kind of blew my mind, basically. Like, this was stuff that I did not learn in medical school.
So give a summary of what he says, because that will be an unfamiliar name to most people watching this show.
Okay, so his name is Neil, N-E-A-L, Barnard, B-A-R-N-A-R-D. And he's actually, interestingly enough, a psychiatrist by training, technically. I didn't even know that. Yes, yeah. It's very interesting. I never asked him how he fell into the path that he's been on. I know the backstory. What he tells people is that he was doing autopsies at one point, and the pathologist that he was working with was kind of pointing out what was going on in people's arteries and how that related to diet, and that kind of had him change his ways. And I think he kind of decided, if I'm doing this for myself, I should try to get my patients to do this for themselves as well. And that's what started it for him. And I don't know the details of his career, but either way, he presented this idea that what seems to be related to diabetes risk is intramyocellular lipids, i.e. fats accumulating in your muscle cells. What we learn in medical school is that diabetes is a problem with glucose metabolism. Your body can't handle sugar. So it was assumed you eat sugary foods, you get diabetes. When in reality, what he was presenting was that our insight into this was limited, that we were kind of narrowing down on the sugar metabolism, when in fact, the actual causative, we're focusing on the symptom and not so much on the actual cause. And that kind of blew my mind. And I guess, unlike some other folks, it's not like I was married to what I was taught in medical school. I mean, it is accepted fact, but maybe I'm rebel. Maybe I think differently. I don't know, but I was open-minded about it. And I kind of intuitively knew that when I eat high-fat meals, I would get sluggish and not feel great. And I think most people know that that's how they feel. Could that have further-reaching consequences? And so this basically, to summarize, got me... It changed my paradigm of medicine and how I view, like, the literature in some ways. You know, I still firmly believe in science, but I also acknowledge the fact that the paradigms have shifted over the centuries. And I kind of realized, just because we're working in the 21st century doesn't necessarily mean that we understand everything about medicine and that we know what's best for people. And we look back to the history of medicine and when people would do things that we consider kind of brutal towards our patients, and realizing maybe what we're doing now isn't always the best thing for our patients too. And it kind of really got me questioning things and kind of trying different things for myself, exploring a plant-based diet for my personal health. And it just began me on this journey where I became, I think, more open-minded towards lifestyle medicine in general, basically. And so that was the first big thing, like that talk by Dr. Bernard. And I've been a member of the Physicians Committee since then. But then the second thing was when one of my colleagues here at the hospital that I work at kind of shoved this book in my face, The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. It looks like this. And
Ginger's reading that right now.
It's fascinating. And again, not something that we learn in residency or medical school, but so much science behind it. And very not well understood, but in some ways, extremely connected to multiple aspects of medicine and health and well-being, both psychologically and physically. If you want to differentiate the two, I think of them as the same ultimately, but very it really kind of made a lot of things that I learned about in residency and psychiatric residency make sense in a different way. You know, like if you don't think it's just serotonin molecules floating around in a vacuum in your brain that cause problems, rather maybe how your brain is interacting with bad things that happen sometimes and how that could be causing changes to your behavior and sense of well-being, that it really kind of changes the paradigm and how we should be responding to these things. These two things have really kind of changed my perception of how I practice medicine and how I try to approach things. I don't have all the answers. I don't pretend like I do, but, you know, I'm willing to acknowledge that maybe sometimes we're wrong about stuff, and I'm open-minded about, like, you know, are there different ways of approaching these issues sometimes?
Well, as a consultant, you're primarily going in as a psychiatrist, right? But that's, you also are general physician, and you're dealing with medical patients. And when did you begin to rethink some of your psychiatry more?
I think it's not just the psychiatry. I think I'm rethinking a lot of things in medicine. I think a lot of things in...
Well, I'm thinking more about the drugs and stuff.
I guess just seeing the limitations, how few people stick to them. Same with substance abuse, but I don't, you know, I guess the street drugs are, they make people feel differently and they prefer how that feels to the prescribed drugs. But it just seems like eventually a lot of times the effects that people like wear off or create side effects, and that ends up becoming a limiting factor. And most people tend to jump ship and try a different drug and not necessarily go with things like psychotherapy or other methods like exercise or lifestyle interventions to see if that gets them feeling better, unfortunately. But that's kind of, that also contributed to things as well. You know, realizing drugs have their limitations. And not just in psych, but in other things. You know, I see it with, you know, is it easier to change your diet or take a statin? And statins have very real side effects too. I could go on and on. It's just, I feel like drugs are extremely powerful and they change things, but I guess I'm starting to question, you know, the long-term efficacy of these things and, you know, really trying to get people thinking about weighing the pros and cons of taking drugs and is it worth it to you? Like, what are you going for? And what do you want the drug to do? And sometimes people have unrealistic expectations of the drugs. Like they think, you know, I'm taking my antidepressant, I don't feel happy. And it's like, why would you think that an antidepressant is going to make you happy if you're life is pretty horrible right now? I mean, you have emotions for a reason in response to things you're going through, and you can't expect a drug to change what you're going through. You know, it's up to you to kind of change your behaviors to get out of a bad situation to, you know, and I know sometimes it's very tough for people to get out of certain situations, but, you know, people have very interesting expectations of what medications can do, especially psych meds.
Well, that they get that from the doctors and the advertising. So when you're talking to somebody in a medical ward who's never heard anything about being critical of psych drugs, what kind of reactions do you get from them? And do you get any blowback from the docs on the ward?
Actually, it's interesting that my colleagues know about the side effects of the drugs. Their patients, I think, tell them in the outpatient and inpatient settings. They see the certain things like with the antipsychotics, dystonia, or the serotonin syndrome you can get with antidepressants. They see these side effects and they will call us to figure out, could this thing that this person got admitted to the hospital for, could it be related to their meds? So that's one of the main reasons why we get involved. So there's no blowback at all, actually. I'd say, I mean, that's with regards to the medications. As far as the patients and the families, it's interesting. Actually, I get the sense that people are kind of getting tired of trying the medications. Just last night, without going into too many HIPAA-violating details, I actually interacted with a family member of a patient, and the patient had been on multiple psych medications over their lifetime. And the family member was realizing, although the family member hadn't really read about the side effects of drugs causing some of these symptoms that the patient had been going through, they kind of realized, like, I'd heard these drugs kind of sometimes stop working after a while. And interestingly enough, by some miracle, I don't know how that happened, maybe it's a sign, the family member whom I'm speaking with basically said, I really think I need to get my loved one on a different diet. This person lives in a group home setting where they don't have control over what foods they eat. They have intellectual limitations, so they can't cook for themselves. So this family member was on the lookout for a registered dietitian to help the group home staff learn how to prepare meals differently for this patient of mine. And my mind was completely blown. Like, this is not a conversation I have on today.
Pam, what do you think the average American's health would change if they went on a plant-based, low-fat, not necessarily, as you say, they could have blue meat 3 times a week or something, but basically on a plant-based, low-fat diet where it's a whole food, not something that's been ground up with a lot of additives, you know, like eating potatoes and asparagus and all kinds of other good basic foods. First, you know what I would love? Give a 5-minute description of what a diet like that looks like.
Yeah, so it's not as strict as people think it is. I mean, you can make it as strict as you want, but really, people would just eat mostly plants, you know. And we're talking about 4 major food groups, fruits, vegetables, people are not surprised about that. Whole grains and legumes, starchy foods like potatoes and squashes and beans and rice and whole grains. So you eat mostly that stuff. You can have animal foods 2 to 3 times a week or fish 2 to 3 times a week. A maximum of 3 servings a week of animal food or fish, as long as it's organic or wild caught. Get rid of the dairy. Minimize the processed food. Like we use a pyramid so people can see, eat less of the stuff at the top than you do at the bottom. And keep the fat really low. And treats are for holidays. So a glass of wine, a piece of birthday cake. I mean, there's a time for it, but that's not food. Difference between food and a treat. And within those categories, people can eat what they want. I mean,
I think one of the things that keeps people from doing this is they sometimes think, gosh, if I'm not ready to eat green apples and kale, then this won't work for me. But if you like yellow apples and romaine lettuce, that works great too. Okay, just eat the food. Well, if we were to get people to mostly do this, we would probably cut the healthcare bill in this country by 2/3. Because most of what we're treating is chronic degenerative disease that is pretty much brought about by poor eating. These are foodborne illnesses. It's somewhat astounding to me that we still have doctors that are saying the food doesn't matter, because the average adult eats one ton of food every year. And you really can't fathom how you could put
a ton of anything through anything and not have it have an impact. I mean, right? So, mm-hmm. So if we could get people to do this, we would eliminate most cardiovascular disease. We would eliminate most cancer. Most type 2 diabetes would be a rare condition. Autoimmune disease cut way down. All the stuff we're spending all the money on would go away. And while psychological disorders are not biological disorders, one thing that can make somebody feel awful from a mental standpoint is being dehydrated, hypoglycemic, and sedentary. Okay, so I think that if we even took our mental health patients and we got them on a health-promoting diet, they get better faster. They get more out of the therapy. If you can show up, I don't know about you, but when I don't show up mentally prepared to do something, not much gets done. So if I don't feel good, I don't listen well, I don't know, not very articulate and all that sort of thing. So if we helped our mental health patients with an optimal diet, they'd show up at therapy able to get so much more done. So it's an inexpensive, whole lot less than what we're doing right now, and it really is a reallocation of funds, because everybody in this country has to eat. So we're just talking about eat some different stuff, right? You're going to just invest your grocery bill differently, and we could really turn the healthcare system upside down. Easier said than done. Right?
Yeah, I think it would be very, very dramatic change in people's health. Certainly has been in all of our health as we've made those changes. Me thanking you for the improvements in my health and Ginger's health. The other thing is that, and here's a big problem and a wonderful thing, both, and that is that people who come for help in their lives from mental health issues, they often are not well organized in their lives. They've had trouble taking charge of their lives. And I think that if, as a part of therapy, they can also begin to diet better, they'll experience the pleasure of actually learning you can take charge of your life. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination. And when parents have children who, quote, they can't control, or have ADD, or, you know, oppositional defiant disorder, well, they're going to get spectacular results if they feel strongly about their children eating better, because they're going to become effective parents. Mm-hmm. And what these children need is effective parents. They need parents who have confidence in their ability to be moral authorities in the lives of their children. And I'm not talking about your deeply disturbed, abused, psychotic kids. They may need some other more complicated things and a lot more emphasis on love and security. But a lot of the children that I see who are having this so-called ADHD, rather than the ones who are coming out of a mental hospital to see me, they basically need moms and dads who have more faith in themselves for giving leadership as well as love and some discipline. And so I just think, especially when we're talking about children, if the parents take charge, it's going to change the lives of the kids
Yeah, I have to share something with you. This could be done, this has been done in group homes where there are no parents around. I want to tell you about something that nobody knows, and this woman should be on every news program. So Anthony and Demas is a friend of mine, graduated from Cornell University. She's done many wonderful things. But probably the most incredible thing she ever did was at a home for violent youthful male offenders in Florida. Okay? And her proposal, which cost $6,000 to do, so keep that number in mind, was to take a group of kids who were willing and teach them how to eat a vegan diet and cook for themselves. And one of the big things they had to go through was allowing male violent offenders to have knives in the kitchen, because that normally doesn't work out so well, but they managed to get past that. And the kids went to the farmer's market and they bought food, and so here's what happens with these young men. The first thing is they all calmed down. They started getting good grades in school. There's handwriting samples that were virtually illegible, which became perfectly legible. One young man wrote about how wonderful it was to learn to eat well, because when he got older and got married, he would be able to do this for his wife. Mm-hmm. These are, mind you, young male violent offenders. They graduated from high school. One of them gave a talk at Cornell University. He had gotten a scholarship to go to culinary school at a music in Florida where he was in this home. And again, the cost was $6,000. And so here's what I think was going on. First of all, these kids were taught to care about themselves. They were taught to the importance of self-care. They were given autonomy to do things, to become that self-efficacy that you were talking about earlier, became very important. And through better eating, their behavior changed, their academic performance changed, and they had a better future. So it's great if you get parents involved, but my gosh, if the parents are long gone, you can still use this strategy.
How do people get in touch with you, Pam? What's the best way?
My email address is pampopper@msn.com. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me. I answer all my own emails.
So. Wow. And do you want folks getting in touch with you, Pinar? I don't know that you were involved in the public.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean,
do you want to give a website out?
I don't really have any publicity or anything out there. I mean,
you're just a working stiff psychiatrist.
Pretty much at this point in time. I mean, I do teach a class for the Wellness Forum. So if they have specific questions of how I operate or things that I've observed, I mean, that's one easy way for people to get some of their specific questions answered. Although, you know, it's the class isn't necessarily about it, you know, medical advice, both either for the students or their family members, but it's more to teach. I think it's more to teach the students how to help themselves and learn more about what's going on out there in terms of medications and alternatives to medications. So that's kind of right now the extent of it. I mean, I don't know what the future will bring. As of now, I don't really have any significant plans. I just try to keep my nose to the grindstone and do my work and try to help people one patient at a time.
I want to go to another question. And it comes out of what you were saying. What does the future hold? So I want to talk, let's see, we've got about 20 minutes left. I want to talk for about 5 minutes about what I'm seeing for the future in psychiatry. And then maybe each of you could kind of talk about what do you see the future holds? And maybe we can go from there. And again, folks, this is an introductory show. If you're just turning in, this is a miracle show in that I have my dear friends, Pinar Miski, who just got up and left because she's actually, she's fixing up her studio.
Trying to get the sun out of my
And head. We are going to be just informal here. Occasionally, I'll be typing because I communicate with my studio by typing. And I'm thinking now that I'm on air visually as well, maybe I need to find a way to communicate with them with a plug in my ear or something. I'm just not sure how it's all going to work. We'll see what happens. I think that psychiatry now is going to be morphing into something more terrible than we ever imagined, and more bizarre and more beyond futurism than we ever imagined. I think good old traditional shock the daylights and drug the daylights out of them and lock them up if nothing else works is going to continue. Involuntary treatment is going to continue, outpatient involuntary. So the general horror is going to continue. But right now, the division of devices of the FDA has approved something called Monarch. And Monarch is a device with a 9-volt battery for putting electrodes on the heads of children labeled ADHD. And the parents are instructed to just have somebody sort of monitor this while your child sleeps through the night, getting electrical stimulation of the brain sufficient enough to change their brain waves and to give them a variety, at least in 4 weeks, of things like nausea and headache and tingling and other things. The tests by the FDA lasted 4 weeks. The limit on the number of months or years you can do for the instrument, zero. The electricity is low voltage, and it is going not probably so much through the skull up where the electrodes are, but it's picking up the ends of nerve roots, particularly the trigeminal, which are nearer to the surface or coming through the skull, little holes and go into your teeth and things. And it's sending the impulses back up the nerves. Now I'm working with a wonderful neurophysiologist who wants to remain anonymous right now. But as best as he can ascertain, these impulses are going up the afferent nerves, that is the nerves that are picking up the sensations. It's going up the motor nerves that are coming down, and it's affecting olfactory nerves, just all of that in the trigeminal nerve. And it goes right on up and finds its way to the frontal lobes and affects the function of the whole brain. The claim is it's getting to those areas that affect ADHD. Well, of course, that's nonsense. It's getting to those areas that produce a human being. And the I've now looked at the applications, you know, for patents, and I've looked at some of the FDA applications. And in fact, their basic goal never had anything to do with ADHD. They think they have something that is going to be useful for every disorder there is. Brain disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, eating disorders, you name it. They think they can stimulate the brain into health. They're going to make the brain sicker and sicker. And putting it on the heads of children when they're trying to sleep, and during sleep, what do? You recover. Your brain readapts and recovers. And this particular gentleman, he's even looking at what happens to cerebral spinal fluid when we rest and when we sleep. And all of those resting processes are being chronically disabled in subtle ways that we have no idea what the long-range effect is. That's the opening wedge, because now that it's approved, oh, by the way, most people, the parents, took their kids out after 4 weeks. And then by a year, every parent but three took the kids out. But there are only 35 kids that they had to approve this. So we're looking at a disaster unleashed on the public by the branch of the FDA that does devices. Now, at the same time, folks, you go to my website, and then the second or third thing you're going to see is a whole brand new thing, which is, you know, stuff Peter Breggin's really excited about that he's doing right now. And you'll see it right there, right away. And it's a little different than the alerts, frequent alerts, which you can actually connect to and have mailed to you. But these, you know, latest, newest, exciting things by Peter Breggin, The Conscience of Psychiatry, I'm just being very bold, you'll be able to get right away. I love Pam grinning about this. She knows this is hard for me to do. I'm breaking out, guys. And you will then see the next level of terror around all of where we go. And the next level of terror is represented by Elon Musk, who is the man who gave you, given us Tesla, the cars that are supposed to be driven by machines and which occasionally blow up or go out of control. He is developing technology where you'll be connected to your computer directly by electrodes. And if you then go down just a little further, I mean, that's what you're going to see when you get to the latest thing I'm working on. That's the first thing you're going to see. Then you go a little further, you get to the child sections, and you'll learn about the Monarch device. So, but they come together. You can see how they come together so, so closely. And it's all about physical control of the brain, which they've been working on for a long time. Now, who is they? Well, I'm working with a wonderful couple who did the film The Minds of Men, which is a big mind control film. I'm in it, seen over 2 million people have seen it now, and I'm the star of the last section. They call me the star or the featured person. And they found out by just searching the web that the machine that Elon Musk is using, in which he says, and you can see the videos, all the videos are there, there's nothing here about this is nothing to do with conspiracy theory. This is public advertising that they're pushing. You'll see the device that Elon Musk is working on and hopes to get approved by the FDA using the same methods that Monarch did by getting it approved for some sort of disease first, is actually funded by the machine, comes out of DARPA, capital letters D-A-R-P, which is a defense agency of the federal government that supports mind control stuff. This is great stuff for the defense agencies. God knows what they want to do with it. But in the past, the federal government, again, this is not conspiracy theory, documented, they have the federal government's promoted ECT, which is bizarre, through the FDA, and they actually funded the worst ECT experiments, some of the worst there were in the 70s. They funded it through the CIA. Just plug in CIA, ECT. You'll get New York Times coverage, or maybe you'll even get some of my work. And I found out that when I was going up against psychosurgery years ago, that the Boston psychiatrists and neurosurgeons be being funded by the Justice Department. So you got all these different departments, and probably the most threatening of all is DARPA, because that's the big one right now, funding mind control. So I see the future, and if I'm hoping I'm leaving you guys some time, we can, on our next episode, I'm planning the next episode to be weekly with Pinar Miskey and Pam Popper. Weekly. Let's see how it goes. Maybe we'll get bored. We'll get tired. Pinar will find it's interfering with her actually being a doctor. Right on the wards. This is coming from the wards where she's at. This I'm seeing is the huge, huge threat of the future. And what they're looking forward to doing, the people who are involved in putting these caps on people's heads and putting in the tiny, tiny little electrodes, but they won't be able to get them out. They're looking forward to enhancing people. And you'll read, if you go and look at my, go down my website and look at my latest exciting stuff, you'll see that they are really looking forward to enhancing the brain. And this is what Elon Musk says. He says, we're in danger of being taken over by computers with AI. And we have to fight back by integrating with computers. Now, if this is not insanity or grandiosity, it's certainly dangerous. So that's where my head is right now. I'm looking at the old Sakai and saying, well, I've been beaten up on them, and I've been publishing about them, and I've been writing about them. But there is something that I first started looking into when I was doing my anti-psychosurgery campaign and reading about physical control of the brain, which a lot of these doctors were talking about back in the 70s, that now they are really doing it. And then one last word. DARPA has now announced, and it's on their websites, and you'll see if you just follow the train on my website, you'll find it. But DARPA is now saying they think they have a way of accomplishing the same thing that Musk is, and they are doing with electrodes on the head without electrodes, of hooking up to neurons. What they're trying to do is hooking up to small groups of neurons and influencing them. Since we have no idea how the brain works, doesn't that sound like a marvelous, healthy thing to do? To just go in there to places we have no idea what's going on. We don't know the operating system, and you're going to just stimulate people. Well, we're doing it now to children in this same kind of basic way, finding a way to get in the brain. They're getting in by finding nerve endings and shooting stuff back up them. And I'm working with this really brilliant neurophysiologist who is going to, I'm telling him he's going to remain anonymous as I'm concerned till he learns about what this is, the dangers of taking stands here. Just what happens when you send the, can we guess what's going to happen? Because they have no idea. The guys who are doing FDA, they got no idea what they just approved. Can we even guess what's going to happen when you send reverse currents? And he has a wonderful word for it. He says these are electronic messages of unknown content. That was saying, it's a little bit my phrase and his together. Electronic messages up into the brains of the kids. And we know it's impacting because it's causing adverse effects and changing the brain waves. Is that really good for a 9-year-old? Hey, kid, let's give you a chronic dose of changing brain waves. And Michael Cornwall's working with me on trying to stop Monarch. We have a new organization, Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children, SPAC, and Michael is directing it. It's coming out of my organization, me and Ginger. He says that it won't be long. He's been around almost as long as me. Before you walk by cars in a parking lot, and mom's parked the kids there in the back, and they're sleeping with electrodes on their foreheads. It's going to be a fad. So I'm going to turn the mic over to you for the, we got about 3 or 4 minutes. Why don't you comment on, we'll talk next time maybe about what you see the future of your worlds. So I really wanted to get that out today. It looks like I really wanted to. I think it's a good opening to the show because this is the terrors we're going to be looking at on this show. This isn't going to be an ordinary show. It's going to be a show that goes where the truth is. we go where the truth is. But any of your thoughts or questions about what I'm learning about this mind control stuff and the monarch?
I'll just make one real brief comment. And I think if you wanted to sum up what's wrong with medicine into one concept, it is, when are we going to stop jumping off the cliff with a new idea that sounds like it might possibly in some other universe be a good idea? And then no proof, no evidence, we haven't done the right clinical trials. Now that we just jump off the cliff and do it, and then later on we say, oh my gosh, that was terrible. I mean, we did it with psychiatric drugs. Look at what's going on with the opioid epidemic. I mean, that was all manufactured, made up. People started prescribing drugs. At some point in time, medicine is going to have to rein itself in. And the drug companies are going to have to be reined in, and they're going to have to be disconnected from their partners at the federal government. That's what we've been talking about that for a real long time.
Right. Pam, you are breaking up a little bit. I think it's my incoming. I don't mind inviting the audience in on this. I'm going to be more comfortable if I don't have a traditional show or I'm doing secret things. I don't think it's your mic. I think it's my input. But where is your mic?
I'm hearing the cracking up when you're talking too.
Okay. I'm hearing a little scratchy sound, but I think that maybe none of this is going to show up on the film. We'll see. If it does, we'll have some work folks to clean up the show for you. We've got a few more minutes. Pinar, you've not heard some of this stuff before. What do you think?
It sounds like something right out of sci-fi, and like a lot of fads. I mean, I think there's what consumers want, and then there's what medicine is pushing on them. And I think there does seem to be a point where there's divergence. I do think that there, even though I know you have an understandable fear of these things happening, and who knows where it's going to go, and especially in the military complex, but basically, from my standpoint, as far as what individuals are going to want, I, on the front lines, am seeing a lot more individuals wanting the lifestyle stuff. They're starting to see the limitations of the system as is, and maybe that gives a glimmer of hope to an obviously concerning or bleak potential future here. That I think the more we educate individuals and let them know about the downsides of what's going on, that maybe they'll be more willing to try alternatives before it gets to the point where they need drugs or these devices. And just really trying to create some awareness of this will go a long way, in my opinion.
Well, I think you're just a necessity on this show and in my life, because I saw that. That is not my way of looking at it at all. But so that's wonderful. And I want you to keep bringing in what you're seeing. You're right, by the way. You spotted it exactly when you mentioned, especially in the military, because a lot of vets have been targeted for these devices that you put on your head. But a study, I think, convinced the VA that it didn't work. And they were doing it without any research. We're hearing the music. Folks, thanks for being on the radio, listening to my first TV show ever. I can't wait to see myself, what it really looks like. It looks great. I'm seeing my friends on the screen looking fabulous and terrific and loving and just, you know, like my friends and dear friends. And we're going to be meeting with Pam Popper, and we're going to be meeting with Bernard Miski, and we're going to be doing it once a month. It's going to be the first session of the month, and we'll see how it goes. And God bless my wonderful audience. Watch it again to see it on TV. I mean, you're going to get a whole different feel from it when you see the way we are together. And thank you so much, Pam. Thank you, Pinar, for being on. Bye-bye, wonderful folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.